Welcome to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast, where we focus on the people, the products, and the process of e-commerce selling today. Here's your host, Stephen Peterson.
Welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. This is episode 67, Caleb Roth. Man, I love this interview, and I love it for a couple reasons. It's refreshing to catch a mature 28-year-old who has figured out kind of the meaning of life. You know, he's already figured out that money isn't everything. Freedom, more importantly, freedom with his wife, which I appreciate, is more important. And I just love the story. I love digging a little deeper and listening to his background as he grew up and the role models that he had that really kind of set the tone for his future. And I think it's really interesting. So let's get into the podcast. All right, welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. And man, tonight's guest was actually recommended to me by someone. They're like, Steve, you have to have this guy on. You know, and listeners out there, that's typically how I find a lot of my guests. I think I've met almost all of them face-to-face once, twice, probably tipped a beer with most of them. But in this case, it came from somebody who is really smart, really into it, and they said, hey, here's a guy who's really smart, who's really into it. You really want to talk to him. Caleb Roth, a.k.a. The Book Flipper. Welcome, Caleb.
Hey, Stephen. Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
And I really appreciate you taking the time. And you know, you're not a book flipper. You're the book flipper.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but yeah, when it comes to the world of marketing, it's nice to be the one that stands out.
You know, I think it's so smart, you know, sitting there, you know, and I look at, you know, a lot of stuff, I get to see behind the scenes, and I look at a lot of stuff that you're doing, and I can see that it absolutely has been thought out. There's nothing unintentional. Is that kind of you?
Yeah, I like to be strategic, probably more so than I should be at times, but yeah, I like to plan things out and have an idea of what's going, almost like a chess match or a game of poker, if you want to use those analogies.
Has it always been that way? I mean, did you grow up that kind of edgy thinking, or was that developed?
Competitiveness was developed in my family. I'm one of seven kids, and I've got a twin brother and a brother a year younger, and the three of us were always going at it growing up. They're both very smart individuals. Both of them actually have PhDs, one in math, one in computer science. And so I'm just the uneducated bum with a bachelor's degree. And we had so much fun growing up, just talking over ideas and family dinners, never a dull moment there.
Well, it must be interesting now at get-togethers, right? I mean, with that much, you know, you can't have that much of an education without a lot of stuff going on or experiencing a lot of stuff. So you know, the conversations must be pretty incredible.
Yeah, and a very diverse background as well. We got computer programmers in the family, two musicians, and my second oldest brother is actually an entrepreneur as well. And so I've learned a lot of what I've done from him and just watching him and wanting to be like him.
That's interesting. So two art type of individuals. And I guess the entrepreneur, I mean, you know, let's talk about that. What would you say? Would you say you're more artsy because of the marketing side and the fact that you get that? Or would you say you're more the analytical side, the computer programmer type?
Definitely more the computer programmer. But a good entrepreneur would have both. It's an art and a science. Marketing would teach you to make noise, to try to stand out, to do things differently than the crowd. And there's a lot of art that goes into that. And that's just getting noticed. But then if you don't have the science or the analytical side to back it up, I think you can fall short in a lot of ways.
I think that's absolutely true. I think most people do fall short. They've never reached that potential because they just can't follow through. They don't know how to act on it and use that information. So what's the other entrepreneur brother do?
He's done a little bit of everything. He's an architect by trade and did that for a while. And he's done everything from running furniture stores to flipping houses to, I mean, you name it, he's probably tried it.
And it's just that's just him. Was he always that way?
He always was.
Because it's hard to look back at yourself, right? It's hard to go back and look at yourself because you don't know what kind of kid you are. You have to, you know, you can only see yourself through your eyes, not someone else's eyes.
Sure.
So it would be neat to ask your brothers about you. But in this case, let's ask about your brother because I'm sure it's pretty similar. So tell me, what was he like?
Well, and he's a bit older. He's 10 years older than me. When he was just starting to hit his stride, you know, 16, 17, I was 6 or 7. So, you know, kindergarten, first grade. The first thing I remember about him is that he was always flipping cars. He had a passion for cars. He knew how to fix them up. And I think, we went back and counted once. I think he flipped about 20 cars just in high school alone.
That's
so
incredible.
He'd buy them, fix them up, get bored, sell it, move on, try and find the next one. And so he always had cars breaking down and car parts everywhere. And he was always just hustling, trying to buy and sell. And I really liked that about him.
Well, let me ask this question because this is, I think, an interesting point. So were any of the real educated brothers much older than you two?
No, both brothers with PhDs. All the ones... is my twin brother, and then my little brother, who's only a year and a half younger.
Because I was trying to figure out, as you were growing up, if you saw both sides of that, and then what attracted you to one side more than the other side. That's what I was trying to see if there was anything that resonated
with
you.
Well, if you want to go there, I mean, I had a great variety just in my siblings. So my oldest brother went off. He was computers as well, works for Marathon and does, manages some of their pipelines and does programming in the backgrounds. So very blue, I guess white collar job. Mm-hmm. And very much just a regular go work for the man. And
how much older is he then?
He's 13 years older.
Okay. So you would have seen that then too, because he would have been just about going in. Well, he would have been in college in that scenario when your other 17-year-old brother, just about, right?
So I had the entrepreneur brother who was always flipping things and always trying to make something work on his own. And then my sister was doing the music thing. So she was pursuing her passion. Mm-hmm. She actually went down and lived in Mexico for a year and helped out in an orphanage. And I just got to see both their lives. You know, the entrepreneur brother made a lot of money, or at least it seemed like he did. And the sister was off pursuing her dreams, and they were both equally happy. And
yeah, that's it. Were they both enriched for them?
Exactly. And so that got me knowing real early on that, hey, it doesn't matter how much money you make, you need to do what is important to you. And, you got to make enough money to put food on the table, but we're blessed. We live in a wonderful country where you have those opportunities. And if you're willing to cut back and live on very little, you can pursue a lot of passions as well.
Well, it sounds like you've had great parents. I mean, if they're allowing you guys to kind of explore, and especially it sounds really diverse. It sounds like they really encouraged that.
They did. They fostered a great environment. And, when you have a lot of siblings as well, you start to compare and challenge each other and contrast. And you just learn so much just from your own family.
Were your parents entrepreneurs? Or
no, they weren't. My dad's the smartest guy I know. He could have easily set off on his own, but he worked, as most people in his generation do, he worked for the same company initially for 5 years and then jumped over and hasn't left since. He's been there another 25 years, and he does field service work. He fixes microtracks and furnaces and all kinds of stuff for Honeywell.
Okay, so he's real technical.
He's extremely technical, but he can fix anything around the house. He can fix cars. He can carry on conversations about space exploration. I mean, you name it, and he could talk about it.
That's cool.
But with 7 mouths to feed, well, 9, including him and mom, it would have been very difficult for him to branch out and do that.
That's really cool. Okay, so you decide, you go to college, you get a degree, and you decide what? Where did you decide to say, because you've been selling for pretty much since you were in high school or college, right?
High school, I kind of dabbled in high school.
Okay. So what was the trigger that, I see that you said you saw them growing up and that kind of thing. But, at some point you realize, hey, I'm going to college and to get a degree and I'm going to go get a job, right?
Yep.
And I'm going to go, and most people, I don't think you really think about it. Maybe it's a generational thing. I guess I'm as old as your father probably.
Sorry, I wasn't going to say it.
But that's pretty close. But then you did get a job and you didn't think anything about that you're only going to be there 3 years or 2 years, which seems to be maybe not your generation as much as the next one, the next 10 years, which I have boys in both. I have a son as old as you and one just 10 years younger.
Sure.
And so, I don't think he thinks in long term about anything.
No, and you could get into that, of course. There's a whole, there's whole elements and whole discussions both ways on that. I think a lot of it, at least for my generation, is one, we get bored easily and we want to move on and just have a lot of experiences. We place a lot of value on experience. And two, we see a lot of companies that aren't, I don't want to use the word faithful, but they're not loyal to the employees. And so as employees, you have to look around and the way to grow and to get promoted, honestly, is to leave the companies and go pursue better offers.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
So, yeah, there's a lot of pieces that play into it, but I didn't expect that I'd find a job and stick with it for 30 years.
Okay. So that wasn't part of your thing. Did you know you would be an entrepreneur? I mean, did it just, that was deep down, no matter what, you're going to have to take a job, pay off whatever, student loans or whatever, but you know someday you're going to branch out on your own.
Yeah, and if – honestly, go back to high school. My very first job, you turn 16, you go – you know, hey, it's time to go get a job, make some money, figure it out. My sister encouraged me. She goes, hey, go find a job where you like the perks. You know, you'll make some decent money, but find something you enjoy doing, and whether it's a restaurant, you eat the food or whatnot. For me, it was golf. There was a golf course across the street, and so I went over there and worked. And back then, minimum wage was $5.15, and I made a few tips. I was the bag boy and got to pick up bags from the cart. But the coolest part of that was I got free golf. So I could go over at, you know, 6:37 in the morning before the sun even came up and get a round of golf in before most people were even awake, and it was free. Mm. So I, you know, I worked the whole summer and made like $1,500 bucks. I think I did, you know, 20 hours a week for, you know, 10, 15 weeks, whatever it was. And I looked at it and it seemed like a lot of money at the time, but I knew that someday there'd be, you know, that wouldn't seem like anything. And, you know, I gave up a lot of nights and weekends, you know, hustling bags and hanging out there. And I realized I'd rather hang out with my friends. And so the thought in my mind was, how can I replace $1,500 worth of income next summer by working for myself? And so that's when I got into, you know, garage sales, thrift stores, whatever else it could be, and just looking for things to flip. I made duct tape wallets. I mean, you're just trying to find anything where you can, you know, spend a few dollars and turn it into a few more dollars.
Where were you selling them?
We were primarily eBay back then. Amazon wasn't built out as it was. We did a few books. My brother was pretty computer savvy back then, my little brother. And this was back before smartphones. And, you know, you're sitting there dating yourself. Well, that's dating myself to some extent. So we didn't have computers in our hand that we could just look up the value of stuff like we can today. And he actually wrote me an application where I'd take my flip phone and I would basically email the book's ISBN to an email address. It would then send that off to Amazon, return the data to the email server, and then send it back out to my phone as a text message.
Oh, my God. So that's genius.
You should have stuck with it. That would be way before the tools.
You would
have
beat Chris Green. You would have crushed Chris Green. See, Chris, you would have been crushed. He would be okay with that. That's funny. But that's really smart thinking about it.
That was before our time. We didn't really stick with it. I didn't really see the potential. We kind of had him develop a couple things, too, once iPhones came out to be able to list books, you know, from your phone. And we just kind of moved away from it. Software wasn't really where we were going and, you know, kind of got away from books and went off to college and pursued a business degree.
Well, it's just neat to see that you stuck with that, though. I mean, you just had that mentality that I'm going to earn my way and earn my way and earn my way. So you go to college. Did you work while you were in college at all?
I did. I was a resident assistant on campus. Okay. I loved college. I went to a small Christian school in Indiana, Grace College, and it was just a great fit. I loved the people. I loved being around it. I loved everything about college. And so I just wanted to be as involved there as I could. And I started kind of got back into books there. People would go to the bookstore and they'd offer them, you know, $10, $12 for a book, and it's selling for $50 on Amazon. So I'd tell the students, hey, you know, bring me your books. I'll sell them on commission. I don't have to buy them that way. And if they sell, I'll take, I think it was 10%. So I undervalued my services, but I would get free inventory, list them on Amazon, and just fulfill them out of my dorm room.
Yeah, but you learned how it works. So I don't know if that's necessarily free. You got paid for tuition.
Oh, it was great.
That's not necessarily a bad thing,
you
know, right?
And then my twin brother was at the same college, and we had the idea, hey, there's a few books. It was a small school, you know, 1,200 students. But there was a few classes that were offered in the fall and the spring semester. So we got the idea of, hey, why don't we kind of be the middlemen and gather the books from students at the end of the fall semester. We'll pay them more than the bookstore, and then we'll flip them to students coming back in the spring. And we'll charge a little less than the bookstore would for used books.
And it's cash.
And it was cash basis. So, and I didn't have the cash at the time. I went to one of my college professors and kind of showed him my business plan and offered him equity or a loan. And he didn't feel right taking equity, although now he's kicking himself, wishing he would have. So he gave me a loan. I think it was like $1,000 or $1,500. And we went off and bought the books and, you know, did the marketing thing, used Facebook, emails, and flip the books, and I think we made about $1,000 for, you know, a month's worth of hustle.
No kidding. So, I mean, that's really smart.
That just kind of, you know, gave us the idea of, okay, there's a market here, how to take advantage of it. We didn't do it again. It was just a one-time thing, but, you know, the wheels were turning at that point.
you recognize the arbitrage, right? You recognize the opportunity.
Yep.
You know, and the other thing is that, you know, in today's day and age, right, you take it all the way out till today where you could deliver it to their dorm. I mean, people are lazy, and I know, you know, think about any of that stuff, right? So you could really, oh, we could custom deliver it to your dorm. I mean, you could really, really offer a lot of cool services.
There's a lot of companies popping up into that space offering some of those unique pieces as well.
You know, I just heard today on a Gary Vaynerchuk video, and I don't know that this is true, but he's made this statement that one of the newest additions to homes, new homes being built, is a door inside the front door for the Amazon box to be dropped in.
I could use one.
The minute I heard that, I'm like, that's cool.
I could use one. We get plenty of deliveries made to our front porch every day.
They couldn't fit anything in mine, but I mean, it's just funny thinking about that. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, that, you know, we might take that for granted, not even really think about that. But wouldn't that be just an amazing feat? I mean, we're seeing delivery coming back for milk in our market. You know, of course, diaper service has always been around, but milk deliveries are coming back and other things. And now we have the grocery delivery companies that are in our town, Peapod and places like that,
yep,
too. So really interesting. Yeah. So I agree with you. So take us from there. What happens?
So we
did you meet the love of your life at college?
I did not, actually. I met her after college. Again, the same professor that gave me the loan, he actually introduced me to her through his wife. His wife's sister went to church with now who's my wife, if you can track all that. But we were both in a
I think I got it so far.
We were both in a small town, and he introduced us, and we met in the park and threw a Frisbee around, and been married for 2.5 years now.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so
and she likes what you do.
She tolerates it.
Okay, well, I was going to say that. What was her background?
Her background was physical education. So she was a PE teacher, loved it. There's no homework to do. She's got a lot of energy, loves that age range. She actually was a PE teacher for kindergarten to eighth grade, which is – That's a tough age range.
Yeah. Ooh.
But she loved it. It got her excited. It was doing what she loved. You know, you don't make a whole lot of money as a teacher, but you get your summers off. There's a lot of flexibility there. So, you know, that those values that she had are kind of what we're after as entrepreneurs as well.
Hmm. All right. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how you – well, I want to finish your career because you do have a marketing career, and I don't want to miss that because I think that is – valuable, again, because I see it in all your stuff. I can see that influence, and I can see you really applying it, and I think that's really smart, and I think in this business, it's a thing that's missing, and so I think you're really going to really – well, I think that's one of the reasons you're moving up so quick in it. And I want to come back and talk about that. I want to talk about your business model and where you see it going. I'm really interested in that. So let's take a quick break. All right, it's early in 2016. You just came off a slamming fourth quarter 2015. You're sitting on a boatload of cash and you're thinking, I want to do something for my business. I want to grow. Start looking at end foundation. Look at them as building blocks. Build, build, build. Change your categories. Think about gated categories, specifically shoes and clothing. YourSourcedInventory.com, that's what they focus on. You'll get a list every single day of the week, Monday through Friday, and they're going to give you leads for about 10 items that are in the shoes and clothing, and even dipping into the sports and outdoor category, which is great. These are all gated categories. Listen to some of these ranks. In October, the average shoe rank was $7,571 for $29 profit, a return of investment of 88%. December, 11,000 ranking, profit of $32, 83% ROI. Think about that. Profit of $32. What's your average selling price? Imagine what your average selling price would jump to. In clothing, ranking in October, $6,800, profit of $1,488. But listen to this. ROI of 109%. What could you do to get that 109% return? You got to join YourSourcedInventory.com. We use it as foundational in our business. We think you should too. YourSourcedInventory.com. Okay, cool kid, right? Here's what's cool. 2/3 of his revenue do not come from Amazon. There's the lesson. You know, when you sit back and take this whole interview in perspective and listen to him, he's given up a six-figure job at a young age. I just see so much opportunity for somebody whose mind is already that expanded. And he is chasing a lifestyle, that freedom that we all say we want, but we're not willing to give up something, because you really do have to give up something, which is probably security and things like that. And he's done it. But I love the fact that 2/3 of his revenue, while it's still e-commerce, is not on Amazon. And I think that's the lesson here.
all the eggs in a basket could be a challenge. I'm not saying it's going to go wrong, but it could. In this scenario, maybe not. So I just love it. I think there's great opportunity here. I hope you open your mind and really think about your business differently. Let's get back into the podcast.
All right, we're back, and we're talking with Caleb Roth, a.k.a. The Book Flipper. Not Book Flipper, The Book Flipper. And I'm teasing him about that, but it's important to say that it does help you stand out. I think that's a fair statement, and I love the way you said it because you believe it, don't you?
I do, and again, it goes back to the marketing element. There's a lot of people that flip books, and you know, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I'm not the best one out there. I'm not the most profitable. I don't have the most sales. But if you're trying to carve out a niche for yourself in any space, you got to be memorable, and the name just kind of came out of nowhere, and we've kind of run with it.
Yeah, how does your family react to what you do?
My parents were a little skeptical at first. And mm-hmm. We'll get to my career in a minute, but quitting a six-figure job and something that's very stable to go work for yourself, they weren't surprised because they've seen that desire in me. Okay. But they definitely wonder about it. You know, my parents-in-law as well at first were extremely skeptical and wanted to make sure I could provide for their baby. And you know, over time you're able to prove that you can, and eventually they jump on board and are in favor of it as well.
And now they start helping you. Well, hey, tell me this: Did you have the excitement when you started your marketing job? That same enthusiasm and excitement?
Definitely not.
Well, that's interesting, because I was wondering, when did it wane? I wanted to know when it waned. But you're saying that your heart was really never in it, in essence.
I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I just, okay. You know, back when you're only trying to come up with $1,500 in a summer, that's doable. And then you question or you doubt yourself, or you wonder if you can build something that's scalable or big enough to actually, you know, pay your bills as you become an adult.
When I see people who aren't doing so well in this business, sometimes it's because they're running away from something. You know, they're running away from a bad job, right?
Sure.
You weren't running away from a bad job. No, just weren't running from a job that your heart was in. You were successful. You were way successful in it. I mean, anybody who's making six figures in that business is successful.
Yeah, and that's a good way to put it. My heart just wasn't in it. It's a great company. I worked for Johnson & Johnson, did marketing for medical devices, so hip and knee replacements. And, you know, it's a growing industry, although the prices are coming down quite a bit as hospitals, you know, buy each other up, and as information gets out there, the prices just mm-hmm. come down. And it's a very tough place to be. But it was a great job. I got to travel the country, see some, you know, even travel outside of the country, meet some awesome people, work with doctors, engineers, scientists, you name it. It was a great job. I really enjoyed it. But I was on the road quite a bit, you know, 30 to 40% of the time. And once you get married, you start realizing, all right, there's more important things. And, you know, the desire to be an entrepreneur and set your own schedule and have that freedom really starts coming back as life changes.
Mm-hmm. I just interviewed Jason T. Smith, right, of Thrift Hunter fame. And, you know, the thing that I came away from his interview is he had a lifestyle before he had a lifestyle business. He has a lifestyle business. There's no question. I mean, he puts in what he wants. He does what he wants when he wants. Him and his wife are so in pair. You know, they know right what they're doing. But he made it match his lifestyle, and that was really important. What you're describing is you wanted your work, I don't want to call it that. I mean, your earnings, your to match the lifestyle you want, right?
Right?
So you don't want to be on the road. And I think that's important, again, because you're not running away from something. I think that's really valuable to note, because I don't think you'll be really or you won't be as successful as you could be in this business because you're trying to run away from something. When you're in here embracing it, you can really do some really good things.
Sure.
Are you putting in 100 hours a week?
Probably not, although my wife would say I probably am.
Okay.
You could put as much or as little as you want, and I think Greg Murphy talks about it all the time too. You know, what are you doing that produces, you know, it's actually revenue generating?
Right. Everything you do. That's what his advice was everything should be revenue generating, or outsource it to somebody else.
Yep. And if I were to look at that seriously and how much of my business is actually revenue generating, I could be working a far fewer hours. I could probably do 10 to 15 hours a week and still have the same revenue we're doing now.
But the fact that you recognize that, I think, is in your mind. So that means it's always going to be there, and you're going to start thinking about it. You'll be like, ooh, that is an opportunity. I'll take those few moments back. You know, and you don't have kids yet. Now, that changes things even more. I mean, obviously, that changes things. But you and your wife both work in the business full-time.
We do, yep. I was able to step away from my job, kind of stair-step down. So I was doing the full-time marketing gig, switched over to sales training, just trying to just spread out a little bit, meet some new people, and just try a different skill set. And then had an opportunity to move out to Denver, which was my dream city, and do orthopedic sales, actually.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know, they were trying to convince me to come out, and it was, you know, I was coming from corporate with the same company.
This is the same company.
Same company, yep. So people I'd met while working, and they said, hey, we like what you're doing. We'd love for you to come out and try the whole sales thing. And, you know, they were, you know, what's it going to take to get you out here? And they were thinking I'd have a number in mind. Well, I didn't. I just needed a number that could, you know, put food on the table and make sure that we're good. I said, I want flexibility. I want to work 3 days a week and make, you know, decent income. And I want to spend the other 2 days building my own business. And, you know, they kind of looked at me funny, but they agreed. And I came out here under, you know, under that assumption, and actually only made it about 4 months. And, you know, I found myself in the operating room thinking every day more about books than I was about bones. And eventually called them up and said, hey, you know, I really appreciate the opportunity. It's been great, but I need to go. You know, I got this burning desire to just go work for myself. And we've built something on the side big enough that I can, and I'm ready to jump in. And he said, okay.
You know, I'm sitting there thinking about the way you just said that. I think you put it so well. Do you think if you would have made it cut cold turkey, you would be as successful or as embracing the business, the fun part of the business, not the job part of the business? You get what I'm trying to ask? Is that, you know, it sounds to me like you made peace with it. It took you 4 months, but you finally made peace with it. This is the right decision. If you just would have went full bore 4 months earlier, do you think you'd be at the same place?
I don't think so. And there's, like you said, there's a lot of strategy to it as well. Twofold. One was I really liked the orthopedic industry, and I was hesitant to just cut off all ties and say, hey, I'm going on my own. I'm going to, you know, run my own gig, and off I go, see ya. So it was almost a way to kind of, you know, step away but still kind of maintain those ties. And, you know, if the books fell apart and it didn't go anywhere, then at least I could claw back in and go full time there or whatever it took. So it was almost a risk mitigation strategy.
Yeah, that's so smart.
The other piece.
28-year-old saying this is pretty impressive. Let me just tell you that.
Well, thanks.
I'm just telling you that. I mean that.
The other piece of it then was, you know, the book business wasn't to the point where we were generating enough revenue to keep the lights on. You know, we made good money, but we were pretty much rolling every dollar back into the business. And having a full-time job or a part-time job that paid well enough allowed us to do that because we could live on that. That was the known. That was consistent. But then we could take the risk with the business and keep pouring the money back in and see what we could build.
I love it, man. I'm telling you, that's a mature thing for a 28-year-old. I'm just going to tell you that, you know, really, really mature to recognize that. And, you know, again, you didn't run away from something. You left something, and it was time to leave, it sounds like. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so you now have a book business in Denver. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so my wife and I buy books from thrift stores. I don't think I said it, but she was able to step away from her job at the beginning of this year. So January 1st, she stepped away fully from what she was doing and joined me in the business, which is great.
But by her choice or by your choice? By your cajoling or her choice?
It was both. You know, I had the flexible business now where, you know, in her mind I could sleep in or travel or do what we wanted. And she was still, you know, punching a clock and working 9 to 5. And so it didn't make sense. And she wasn't making a whole bunch of money with it. She loved it. It was a great company here in Denver. But if you're going to have a lifestyle business and we don't have kids or pets, let's take advantage.
So that was attractive to her. And she saw it and saw that it was meaningful. I mean, it could really produce. And so she realized that. That's interesting.
Yeah,
so that's a way to bring somebody on board sometimes is by demonstrating.
It is. And she's great. She's very grounded. The reason we built this business into what it is today is because she said, you know, back at the beginning, I wanted to quit my job a year and a half ago. And she said, no, we're not there. We don't have any income. What are you talking about? And so she said, prove to me that this can work. And that's how we started building the business. I said, all right, let's find something scalable. I knew that books worked from the past, and we started getting back into it. And we were still merchant fulfilling everything. We had, you know, an inventory of 300 or 400 books out of our house. Nothing crazy, but we're shipping.
Not Greg Murphy level.
No way. But we were shipping out, you know, 3 to 5 to 10 orders a night, and it was just annoying. We'd come home from a long day of work, You want to just sit and relax and talk and watch TV, eat dinner, and you got to package these books and get them out. And we said, this can't continue. And a buddy, actually my first boss at work, Ryan, was like, hey, you got to try this FBA thing. And so we kind of just talked it over, convinced each other that's what we needed to do, and off we went and never looked back.
No kidding.
And so we built the business, and you know, I'm a numbers guy, so I, of course, busted out a spreadsheet and said, all right, here's how this is going to work. I knew roughly we would sell 2 to 3% of the books we send in each week, which is extremely low, but it's consistent. And I knew that if we, you know, if we send in 100 books a week, we'd sell 2 or 3 the first week at 15 to 20 bucks a piece, nothing to write home to mom and dad about. But what if you kept doing that? You know, the power.
Right. When you're up 10 weeks, right?
Exactly.
You 10 weeks. You know, and you're saying it's 3%
of inventory,
3% not 3% of what you set in.
Yeah, inventory. Okay. So if you have an inventory of 1,000, you should sell roughly 20 to 30 a week. And in this business, it's all about what's current. If you stop sending an inventory, it'll get stagnant and stop selling, of course.
Well, before you go any further, is that still true today? You're a couple of years into it. Is that still true? Roughly 2 to 3% of your inventory levels, regardless of size of inventory, is still about right?
Yeah, it's fairly consistent. We actually set our numbers from that first year. We've been doing FBA now for maybe 15 months.
Okay.
And we set those numbers and said, all right, 100 books a week part-time. We can find, you know, nights, weekends, holidays, whatever, we'll find enough books and we'll do that. And we knew that by the end of that first year, we'd have, you know, X amount of books in inventory, X amount would have sold theoretically. And we went back and looked at our numbers from the first year, and we were fairly close to what we estimated.
So you're filling a pipeline in essence, really. You're building a pipeline, but then you're filling it, and
yeah,
you're just going to get it to a level, you know, and we could talk about your 2016 goals, but it's, you really are slowly, you know, you're not doing the Greg Murphy tractor trailer loads yet.
No. And it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. This you know, books don't sell quickly. It's not like toys.
Right.
It's not like some other categories on Amazon that you can, you know, send 100 in and sell them all in the same week. But a lot of books are long tail. A lot of guys like to use that, you know, the Chris Anderson philosophy there. And so you mix your books. You find a bunch of books that are fast nickels that are going to sell quickly and get you your money back, and you mix it with some slow dimes that are going to sit there for a while. And you analyze your inventory. You always ask questions. You're always trying to dig in and see if what you're doing makes sense, if what you guessed was going to work is actually working. And you just keep focus. Like you said, you focus on the pipeline. You fill the top of that funnel. If your goal is 100 a week, get your 100 in a week, no matter what, and see what you can build.
You know, as I read your goals for next year, I'm thinking that. Do you stop when you hit your goal? So last year, your goal was to put 100 in a week. Did you – I mean, you probably – you know, I imagine there's an urgency – right, and there's a panic that sets in when you're only 30 books in, and it's starting to get to Wednesday, and you're, oh, what am I gonna, you know, I can sense that piece. What happened though when you hit your target?
I'm not as disciplined as I could be, so we didn't necessarily do 100 a week. I'm looking back at my metrics here. We started in November. I only listed 219 books, so that's 50 a week.
Okay.
You know, December we did 292, so we were ramping up. January just shy of 600, so we did about 150 a week. And it just kept growing from there. June, we hit 1,200, and we've done almost 1,000 a month actually now, so a little over 250 a week.
Yeah, 250 a week. That's a pretty good pace. That's a pretty good clip. And you say you're buying these at mostly thrift stores.
Yep. So thrift stores, library sales. We'll go to garage sales. I've never met a store I didn't like, so we'll try stuff out. You know, Craigslist finds, selling commissions.
Auctions, once in a blue moon for an auction.
Yeah, estate sales.
Sure.
You know, college books, sales, that kind of stuff.
Now, are you scanning with a PDA or are you scanning with a phone at this point?
Scanning with a phone. We use a seller tool, so FBA Scan.
Okay.
It's a great – it's a downloaded database, so if you're in a basement without cell phone access, you can still pick up, you know, the data. Working on building our own. I got a love for numbers. My brother's a computer programmer, so we're working on, you know, pulling our own data and building our own database and eventually hoping to have our own book app, actually.
But it's so smart. You know, you mentioned A-Seller tool. That's what I was using 4 or 5 years ago. I'm dating myself again, you know, way back. And it was a PDA, though. It was this giant PDA. I mean, you couldn't hide it. Like, my phone's pretty small, and the little scanner's real small. This thing is huge.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, it you know, it's a good, you know, 10 inches long, and it had that thing that the extra scanner on the end that always broke, and it always, you know, so, and you had to have a second one.
Yeah,
you're not
hiding it all when you're out there scouting.
And the download took forever. You know, I was one of the old downloads, and it was crazy how it used to download, but then they came up with a newer version. It was easier. So I remember those days, but boy, it responded so instantly. I mean, it was, as you said, didn't matter. You weren't in a, you could be in the worst basement, and usually in a library sale you are, and boom, you just got it instantly. So that was very cool.
And that's the beauty of it. It's quick, and you're just out there treasure hunting. You don't know, you know, you get better as you go of kind of pre-scanning the books or understanding which books may or may not be worth money. When you start, you just scan everything, and even the fiction, just because you don't know better. And over time,
for library sales, you go to the sections that you know you're going to turn, right? I mean, that's easier, right? You just don't start, oh, this is the closest spot to the door.
Yeah,
you're,
there's definitely,
you know,
some
what
strategy.
You sell.
Yep.
Yeah. Is it still? I haven't been to one in a long time. There used to be some pushing and shoving back in the old days. You know, how is it now? Is it competitive?
It's extremely competitive. Back in Indiana, we just moved out to Denver, you know, 6-7 months ago. In Indiana, we maybe would see one or two other scouters at these sales. And so we could literally go into these, especially smaller town sales, and have free rein. You didn't have to hurry. You weren't pushing. There wasn't any sense of urgency. You could just take your time and work through every book if you wanted. Out here in Denver, it's a different story. There's probably 15 to 30 scouters at every one of these big sales. There's not a lot of pushing and shoving. I think most people are fairly friendly, or at least not extremely aggressive. But there's guys that'll hustle through, and you know, they don't have any regard for the old ladies just trying to find a book to read, and they'll just pull books out, and it's kind of sad to see it. They're fairly rude to the organizers and everything. And
yeah, that doesn't sound like that changed very much. Yeah,
no,
I've experienced some of that.
Anything
yeah.
that's competitive, you're going to have people that get bent out of shape over it.
Yeah, and take it personally, and like, oh my god,
yeah,
you know.
There's plenty of books. I mean, Greg Murphy's an economist, and you know. The whole theory of supply and demands, I think Greg just throws that out the window when it comes to book. You know, there's so many books out there.
He turns away so many more than he ever takes.
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
And it's crazy to hear that. And you think, no, that's impossible. No, it's true. I've seen it. I've seen his place. It's crazy. And he's just so masterful at it. He's the right guy to run that business. I'll tell you, it takes a special person to do that.
Certainly.
And he is exactly the right guy.
Yep.
He's got the right attitude about it. You know, but then again, you're hooking up with them. And, you know, I made this comment before pre-show. We usually talk a little bit. And we had a great discussion about how two smart guys are getting together. That's always a good thing. You know, and a lot of people feel threatened by that. So, obviously, Greg wasn't intimidated by you, and you weren't intimidated by him. And I think that that's just so cool, because two good minds are going to make better decisions and better, you know, and better thinking, you know. And I just think that's just so smart. And a lot of people are still afraid of that.
Well, and I came from a very cutthroat industry with orthopedics. There was five companies at the time. Now two of them have merged, and so there's only four. And everything, you're trying to closely guard it. It's all about, you know, smear campaigns and how can you sell against the competition and all that. And it's just, there's that, you know, the mentality that there's limited supply and you just got to fight for, you know, every percentage point. When it comes to books, and you start, there's so many different business models. Greg's going the bulk route. Brian Young is hiring other people. He's outsourcing. There's guys that, you know, jump. I think Jerry Siegel jumps in an RV and runs across the country buying books and other items. There's literally dozens of business models that can work in this industry, and you're foolish not to talk to other people. You know.
Yeah. And the other, that competitive stuff takes away your soul. You know, I believe that stuff. That every time you're in that environment, you become it. I hate to say it that way. It just takes away a piece of your soul. I don't want that stuff in my life. You know.
Yeah. And you know, I'm a victim of it. I'm definitely competitive natured, and I've definitely found myself in situations where you start coming up against people, and you just gotta either, like you said, it's gonna tear you apart, or you got to just step away. I've got Greg's mentality. I'll learn way more from talking to other scouters or other book people than they will from me. No matter where this business goes, or you know how big the blog gets or any of that kind of stuff, I'm always going to learn something from talking to somebody, and that's the right mentality to have.
Mm. Yeah, and I think everybody has something to offer, and I think if you go about it that approach, you will learn a lot, right?
Absolutely.
And if you go in thinking you know it all, you won't. Did you have any fear? I mean, here you are. You know, relatively young guy, providing for his family. Do you still have fear? I mean, do you, has the model proven itself far enough along? You know, you don't have to run into the fear generally of having your account closed for counterfeits, right? Worst thing you'll have is an international edition or not as described. You could get a bunch of those, and you get a whole bunch of slaps before then. So you wouldn't have that fear, I don't think.
Yeah, that's not really a big fear when it comes to books as far as getting shut down. Obviously, we're playing an Amazon sandbox. You know, I like to talk about, I'm an entrepreneur and I built my business, but I'm just playing an Amazon sandbox all
along. Yeah, you're 100% dependent upon them. I mean,
no,
as long as they stay in business.
It's a chunk of my business. We've got a couple other things as well, but everything is related to books in some way.
Okay.
So for your fear question, no, I think a healthy amount of fear is good for you. If you're not afraid or you're not testing things out or not concerned, I think you're probably overly confident or arrogant, and that's when things are going to go south for you. But yeah, to your point, am I really concerned that the business is going to, you know, die tomorrow? Not really.
No, and I think that's a smart approach. I saw that Amazon's talking about opening bookstore. Yeah. I don't know that they said that. I've read that somebody wrote that. So is that rumor true?
I don't know if it's true or not. They're always tinkering with something. You know, they never hit their sales numbers or rather their profit numbers, because they're always playing with something. Bezos, he really fosters an environment where people can play and try and experiment. I think the rumor got started from a mall developer that was looking at plans and said that maybe 200 stores were going to go in. So whether there's any truth to that, I don't know. The reality is Amazon loves selling other people's stuff, whether they're going to just have publishers provide it to them or they sell our stuff as third-party sellers. So if they make these stores, my hunch is that, yeah, they'll have some new inventory in there, but they may list those prime items that, you know, Fulfilled by Amazon sellers have. They may actually have our books in their stores.
Yeah, it would make sense to get them out of the warehouse and into a place where somebody can put their hands on them.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, and then you could still ship it if a customer bought it online.
Exactly.
So I'm not concerned. The more Amazon grows, the better off they do, the better it's going to be for me and for all the sellers out there.
I think that's a smart attitude, and I think you're exactly right. So you have a book flipper website.
Yep.
Thebookflipper.com. Right. Tell me about that.
Well, really, that was born out of just a desire to build a community. I didn't have a lot of experience, you know, doing blogs. I'd started one or two in the past, like most people, and it never got past the second post. And I knew there was a community of booksellers out there, and there was a couple blogs out there already, but not a lot of them were data focused. And so I really just wanted to start something where I could. It was just a testing ground for myself to throw out some numbers, throw out some ideas, and see if any of it stuck. And really just build a community, because as I stepped away from a corporate job and a life where I interacted with sales reps and surgeons all the time, I knew it was going to get lonely. And so I wanted to build that community selfishly, just to have people to talk to and people to email and people to comment and share and kind of foster that sense of learning. And that's really where it got started from.
Well, it's very complete. I mean, first off, it's well done. So you could tell its marketing eye has been put to it. But there's a lot of depth. I mean, I'm really not surprised. I don't want to use that phrase. I'm drawn to it because there's depth. And I like that because I can see – I know what the effort it takes. I mean, obviously, I would know that, right? But I can see it. I appreciate that. And I think, you know, if someone was interested in getting in this business – well, getting past the hobby side of the business, I think there's a lot of depth in here, and I think there's a lot of value. And I think people will get a lot of from it, and I'll have, of course, links to it, because I just think there's some – you know, books seem to have a little bit of a resurgence out there, I notice, in some of the circles. And maybe it's because of what we talked about earlier, you know, the toys, the fast-turning toys. Well, that's a two-sided sword, right? It's good news is they turn fast. The bad news is the price can drop almost instantly.
Certainly.
And so people get in, and all of a sudden everybody else gets in, and then it's like, whoa, what happened? And the price falls, right? Because that demand is only so much, so it's got to be – and the supply gets real high, the price is going to fall.
Well, and
it doesn't seem to happen with books.
Not as much. And books, you know, of course, textbooks, you can make a lot of money with that. You can buy them in the off season and flip them back during textbook season, or you can just flip them, you know, around the clock all throughout the year. There's always good deals to be found. But – books are still the number one category, sales category in Amazon. And as much as we can interpret from their data, they're selling 100,000 unique titles every hour.
Wow.
So, yeah, why would I build my own website and try and sell my own books if I can just tap into, you know, their fast-moving pipeline and just jump in?
So let's talk about your process, because you're not doing this alone, you and your wife,
yep,
of course, but you have help.
We do.
So let's talk about that.
Sure. Well, we don't have any full-time employees like Greg or some of the other bigger operations do. What it started was we were buying a lot of textbooks to sell to college bookstores. So we were kind of helping supply to them. You know, there's a big used book market, and they can buy from wholesalers. They can buy from us. They've got opportunity or options, rather. And so
– Well, wait, because actually you're the first person who said that to me. So a bookstore – most colleges I'm familiar with are owned by Follett or any of those big players, Barnes & Noble, a couple of them, right?
Yep.
They, or these other smaller colleges, they will buy from individuals or businesses, because you're a wholesale business, in essence, or a used book business.
Yeah, so you're calling me out here. Basically, there's wholesale companies like the Folletts, like the Nebraskas, mm-hmm. like some of the other bigger players. And there's some even smaller bookstore chains that all kind of have a co-op buying group, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. And so we basically supply to them.
Okay.
We were able to get their buy lists, if you will, and basically find
– So there's a relationship there, and that's where you start, and that's what you do. Okay. Yeah, all right. Don't tell us your secrets. I just don't want to miss that, because – my first vision was, you know, the bookstore manager calling you up, hey, do you got this book laying in the back room? Or, you know, obviously that's not the case.
No,
it's much more sophisticated.
Sophisticated, more strategic. You know, they know how many books they're going to need, and, you know, they'll give us a set price, and if we can go find them cheaper than that, awesome.
Yeah, that is smart. That's smart. That's smart business.
Well, and it's branching out. Like you said, you're not putting all your eggs in Amazon's basket. You know, a third of our sales last year were on Amazon, and two-thirds of it was this outside of Amazon piece of it.
Oh, wow. That's really impressive. That's really impressive.
And so this is where it got born of. We were basically ordering books online, you know, on Amazon and other websites using some software we had to find these books. Mm-hmm. And we were getting, my wife and I, you know, 400, 500, 600 books a month showing up on our front doorstep. And we spent
– You were going to fulfill to the colleges.
Yes. So we had to check the books in, make sure it wasn't international editions, make sure the ISBN matched, make sure there's no water damage. And so we just turned into a giant processing warehouse out of our house. And that much stuff in your kitchen eventually stresses you out, or it stresses my wife out. And we started looking at it going, all right, we can either spend our time buying more books, or we could spend our time processing books. So it's time to get somebody else, you know, in on this. So we had a friend from college that lived in the area, and she was a stay-at-home mom with two boys, and she was just looking for some part-time income. We kind of approached her and said, hey, would you be willing to basically let books show up at your front door, check them into a spreadsheet, and then, you know, send them out, you know, mail them back out to these colleges? And she goes, absolutely. So we said, hey, we'll pay you $1 a book to process them. Seemed like a good number at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Off we went, and it was wonderful. One, it's way less stress at our place, so there's not books cluttering up the kitchen, the bathroom, the bedroom, everywhere that we could fit books. And two, more importantly, it's putting money in someone's pocket that's, you know, staying home, caring for her family. So it's kind of a win-win, and we were able to use that time instead of processing and fulfilling orders, or, you know, basically just processing books. We could then go buy more books, and our time was way more valuable doing that than it was processing the books.
Well, a couple questions come to mind, but I absolutely agree with you. And more importantly for her, she did it around her schedule, right?
Sure.
You weren't saying, hey, you got to have these done. You got to work for the next 2 hours. Oh, you got 10 minutes off. No, her kids came in and life happened and whatever.
Well, that's
exactly
and somebody why got sick. We gave her $1 a book. I love motivating people and incentivizing people to, if you work harder, you can make more money. So we've had her time herself. And if she really puts, you know, nose to the grindstone and really goes at it, she can process 40 to 50 books in an hour.
Holy
so that's
cow.
Phenomenal money, and then we start going, wait, we're overpaying. But the beauty of that, like you said, she's not tracking time clock. She's not trying to figure it out. If we send her 200 books in a month, she gets $200, simple as that.
Well, can you talk about the process a little bit more there? So she's entering them in a spreadsheet, the ISBN, right? So how does she know what college to send them to? That's this proprietary software or whatever?
Not really. The software helps us find the books. What she's doing and what we do with her is we pick one wholesaler and they all go to her. That way it's very simple and she's not mixing up the books.
So then it just puts it in a box, the label, puts
away
on it.
So we use Google Drive, the spreadsheet's there, we can edit it, she can edit it. She'll let us know if stuff needs to be returned, if it showed up and it's okay, and then we're able to fill the paperwork out and send them in and get paid.
That's amazing. I mean, and so basically you're not touching in that scenario. It's online arbitrage at its best.
It is. And literally I was doing this while I was working the corporate job too. So I'd be on an airplane, you know, flying from Indiana to California, and I would jump on my laptop, you know, pay for the internet, and I'd go buy books and, you know, make several hundred dollars while on an airplane and never touch a book.
That's just great.
And that, you know, that's kind of the aha moment. Like there's something here.
So that's not the only person you have working for you, though.
No, we've since branched out. We started mostly with family. Both my sisters help out with it. It's been a great testing ground and a business proving ground. I've got nephews now that are, you know, 12 and 10, And so they're now processing books and learning what it is to work. And I ask them questions mm-hmm. about margins and, you know, trying to just get their business brains churning at a young age.
Well, and what's neat to me is they're seeing what you saw, right? So thinking back when you were a kid, right, and maybe a little bit older, but when you saw your brother, that entrepreneur thing, and that kind of stuck with you, whether it didn't stick immediately. Well, I guess it did stick. It just didn't come out until you were a little bit older to be a standalone business. I think that's cool because you're exposing. Now, maybe one of them is going to go be a computer programmer, but the one that turns out to be an entrepreneur might never have been had you not showed that.
Yeah,
so I think that's
pretty
cool.
And I hope so. It's funny watching the young minds. I'm not a father yet, but it's fun watching the young minds and how they process things. You know, mm-hmm. as a marketer, I'm always trying to do something different. This is just a random story, but I was going to go do a half marathon up in Traverse City with my other brother, and my twin brother is actually a runner, and he was going to run it as well, and I didn't put the training in. So we're sitting there the night before, and I'm debating, do I even want to do this thing? It's going to hurt. I'm not really, you know, prepared for it. And we just kind of threw the idea out. Hey, let's run this, you know, let's do a three-legged race the whole way. And so we went out, bought some T-shirts. We're twins, so we put Twin Turbo on our shirts. And then, of course, if we switch legs, it'd be Turbo Twin. So it made sense both ways. And we went out and ran this half marathon three-legged style the entire way. So
that's
what
hilarious.
Was born out of, you know, hey, I'm not prepared to do this, you know, fight or flight mentality changed into, all right, how can we change the game? And so we were featured on the front page of the newspaper, a bigger picture than the actual winner of the race, which is, you know, that's how marketing works, I guess. We got on the mm-hmm. nightly news. And so my nephew kind of saw all that. He kind of came to me and said, so wait, you did something different and you got noticed. Is that how it works?
Yep.
And you could just see the wheels in his mind turning. It's like, yep, that's how it works. You do something different, do something unique, and that's what stands out.
So his exposure there, I mean, you could have tipped, you know, a snowball. You think about a snowball coming
sure.
down, you know, a mountain, right? You could have just tipped that little snowball, and it might take years to turn into something incredible.
Sure.
But that's a really cool story.
Yeah, he'll remember me when he's big time,
yeah, rich and famous.
Exactly.
You know, you're carrying books, and you're saying, "Hey, get the books for me, buddy." Okay, so you got a pretty large group of people working for you, and they're sourcing books, or are they processing books, or is it a mix?
It's a mix. About half of them are the processors, again, more of the stay-at-home type, and it's just a way to provide for their families in a flexible way that fits their schedule, which is great. I'm extremely proud of that. And then we've recently started hiring. My brother-in-law, first of all, kind of saw what we were doing with the books and was looking for something to make a little extra part-time income, and we kind of said, all right, well – you know, we've got the spreadsheet kind of set up. We can bring you into the business. We've already got, you know, a good feedback and established account. Why don't you just list books into our account? We'll figure out some sort of commission structure that makes sense. And so we stumbled through that. We've changed the commission model a few times to make sure it works for both parties. And we kind of tweaked it, fine-tuned it, and recently have started hiring even more scouters. And
could you elaborate on that? I mean, is that too personal?
No,
I don't
fine.
Want to know your brother-in-law's thing, but I've had lots of people talk about their model, and I think there's the more you see, it just opens your eyes up for other things, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, I'm happy to share. Most of the models out there involve just paying some sort of a fixed rate per book. So you might buy the books
right.
back from the scouter and then pay them $1 commission per book. And that works. And again, the more they get better at it and the faster they can find books, again, they can make more money per hour. So I like that incentivization structure, if that's a word. But the challenge there is that they're going to be finding $50 and $60 and $100 books every so often, and you're just paying them the same dollar. So I wanted to build something that, you know, if they got good at finding these high-quality books, they'd make more money. And since I've got a spreadsheet, I've got an accounting system built that works for me, we can simply tag, you know, we basically use a SKU and put their name in it. So what we do is they pay for the books. We pay for the inbound shipping to Amazon to kind of limit their risk so they don't have to have so much cash flow up front. And then as the books sell, we take like $1 a book back that helps us basically set aside to pay for the shipping, pay for their app, pay for all their, you know, the overhead that we have in running it. And we take 20% off the top.
And they get the remainder.
So Amazon then takes their chunk, and then they'll get the remainder. And it's cool. My brother-in-law sold, I have to go look at it, but I think just over $2,000 last month. And so that's some pretty good part-time income going back into his pocket.
And again, let me see if I understand this. I don't have one of the. Well, I guess I do have a fancy degree, but you know, selling a $10 book, you don't make as much money as selling a $100 book.
Correct.
Right.
On a $10 book, FBA fees are going to take roughly half of that. and then we're going to take $2 plus a dollar. So we're going to take three, and you're basically left with two. So
that's okay, right? I mean, you don't want to walk past it.
Right, but
if he sells a $100 book.
Yeah, Amazon's going to take their roughly $20. We're going to take roughly 20 bucks, and they're going to walk away with 60.
So let me think about that. Let's see. Which is a better incentive plan? I think you figured out a better incentive plan.
We hope so.
And I think because ultimately you want better quality inventory. Here's the problem. The $10 book might never sell. I mean, you know, there's just so many. When you're down at that price, there's not a barrier to entry, right? It's just everybody's got, I mean, whatever.
Yeah. And so we've actually run our numbers, and I'm about ready to change my whole philosophy. My basic philosophy is if I can sell the book for $8 to $10, I'll buy it. You know, if I can get it for 50 cents or a dollar. I went back and looked at my data, and books that are under $11, and this is stuff I haven't even put a blog article out, but I will be in the near future. Books under $11 are 33% of my inventory. So a third of my books, a third of my effort, a third of my time is spent on books that are under $11. And the overall profit on those is 3%. So like their overall contribution to my total profit is 3%. So I'm spending a third of my time and making a third of my profit, or 3% of my profits.
So it's just not worth the effort.
It's not.
There's a lot of reasons for that, right? And you have the worst part of it because you guys are handling it not through machinery. Like a lot of the bigger places, they just use machines that process those books, right, where they could just churn them out hundreds and hundreds an hour. You're actually paying, you know, a pretty good chunk of the revenue. So there is a big difference in cost structure for you.
Certainly.
So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But it's cool that you got there, right? Again, you wouldn't get there without all this – without this education, without this experience, without this confidence. All this stuff is related, and it gets you to where you are, which is really – man, I can't wait to hear about the conversation you and Greg have. Man, I'm excited. I wish I was in there with you because I'd be like, oh, my God.
Come on out.
I got too many smart people. I'll carry your drinks or something. I mean, geez.
Greg's been a good friend, and we've been always kind of bouncing business ideas off, and he's just coming out to Denver on vacation, and – like you better
tell him to bring that pizza. Tell him to bring Marianne's pizza. Tell him I said to bring Marianne's pizza. That stuff's good.
I will.
Okay, so you've really have figured out a lot of what not to buy, and I think that's the art of most business, right? And this, especially in the e-commerce business, you really have to learn what not to buy. And as you said, you could still make a little bit of money on the $11 book, and there are people that'll do it. Again, I still say the ones with the machines will do it much more efficient than you can.
Sure.
So learning not to buy. What else have you learned? What are some of the absolutes that you have?
Yeah, a lot of it's data-driven, and that's kind of the focus of my website, is that I like to challenge the status quo or challenge people's assumptions. So there's a lot of, you know, rumors running around out there. You know, don't buy books with a sales rank over a million. They'll never sell. And I said, okay, is that true? And I started tracking it, and you realize that's not true at all.
Okay, good. I was hoping you were going to answer. So it's not true.
No,
okay,
it's not.
Good.
And you develop a buying philosophy that makes sense. You know, I'll buy a book that's 10 million rank if the price is high enough. So I have my own rules that I follow, and I share some of that out on the blog. A second piece of it was the list price. You know, if it's under $10 or $11, as hard as it is to walk away from it, I'm probably going to start doing that in the near future. So there's a lot of things you can understand and learn by looking at your data. There's a lot more that can be learned just by talking to other people and ask questions about their business model, listen to podcasts, read books. It's important to look outside the industry because no matter what you're looking at, whether it's orthopedics or online businesses or what have you, there's something to be learned. There's transferable skills, and there's tips and tricks that you can then take from that and apply to your own industry and maybe do something that's, you know, wildly new in the industry that you're in.
Well, you disrupt it, right? So I interviewed Brandon Dubsky. Now, Brandon is a, you know, seven-figure seller, and his product is very cool. He owns it. He sources it directly in China himself. And he said, you know, at one time he was one of the top 10 eBay sellers. Now, just think about that.
Wow.
Being one of the top 10, that's how big his company was. Failed miserably. It went under everything else about it. So he went out to restart his life over and his business over. And he said, you know, Steve, the breakout for me was I went to an Inc. 500 conference. It had nothing to do with Amazon or eBay, nothing. None of the people there even sold on them, generally speaking. And he said it expanded my vision because the barriers that he self-imposed, years of experience because that's what he knew, it changed his whole point of view. And I think you have a fresh point of view because you're coming in from another industry and you had some freedom in that industry and some success. And I think that fresh perspective is very, very important. And I value that myself. So
yeah, and
very cool.
Hopefully I never lose it. You know, I tell people I'm not passionate about books. I'm passionate about business, and books is just a particular niche around which I've built a business right now. You know, if people ask, well, what if books fail within 5 years or no one's reading or everybody's gone digital? I'm not worried about that on the first hand. But secondly, I hope I'm not doing books 5 years from now, or that I've outsourced it or automated it and it's just running in the background.
You've earned a skill set, right?
Sure.
You've invested in a skill set. You've grown a skill set that can be transferred to you know, pretty much any commodity. And it doesn't even have to be a physical product, correct?
Exactly.
Okay. So you know, there's a lot of depth in this website, in your blog. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, I'm looking at the definitive guide to interpreting a book sales ranks. You're doing some interviews. You got goals out here for next year or 2016, this year. Mm-hmm. And so you got some really cool stuff. But I see this little thing up in the top right-hand corner, eFlip, online sourcing software. Tell me what that is.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up. I didn't want to do too much self-promotion, but
yeah, you know what? I mean, hey, it is what it is. People want to learn. I mean, you're selling books, right?
Yeah.
What makes you different? What's interesting? That's what people want. You know, they want to understand things. So perspective is good. So I'm not embarrassed to say it. There it is.
Sure. Well, eFlip it's kind of under the BookFlipper brand, if you will. And we've got a couple software projects in the works. This is the first one that we went with. And again, it's born out of my love for data. And the basic idea with it is you're buying books on Amazon, so online arbitrage, and you're selling them back on Amazon. And the way that works is people that sell Prime, the prices can be ridiculously higher in some cases, especially with textbooks or niche books or ones with few offers out there. And so you can actually buy a book from a merchant fulfilled seller, wait the 7 to 10 days for it to show up at your front step, make sure, again, you're processing the book, make sure it's the right book, make sure it's in good enough condition, and you're flipping it back around and selling it via FBA. And it's not uncommon to find books out there that are selling for $4, $5, $6 plus shipping. And you could turn around and sell them for $30, $40, or even $50.
Because they're not going back out and reevaluating their inventory or the fact that it's Prime versus Merchant Fulfilled.
Exactly.
You're saying that's the value that you can get that. So you call it FACS. FACS.
Yep.
Tell us what that means.
Yeah, so again, any good marketer will bust out acronyms, or any good pastor mm-hmm. will bust out acronyms. Just something easier to remember. I wanted to do FACTS or FAQS
right.
or something.
Just the facts.
Yeah,
just the facts.
You got
yeah,
it.
I get it.
So it's filter, and what that is Amazon doesn't give us all of the data. So there's a lot of API limitations when you're trying to access a book's information. If they would tell us what the lowest Prime offer is every time, this software would be very simple. It would just be what's the cheapest merchant fulfilled, what's the cheapest Prime, and find books where the differential is, you know, 40% or greater. And off you'd go. They don't do that. So we have to give you tools. And I like this. We're not giving people a list of 10 books to flip today and another 10 tomorrow. All the power's in your hands. So you get filters. You can adjust for the number of used offers, new offers. You can say, I only want to spend up to $10. So I'm going to filter out anything above that. I want to find books that Amazon's selling for $50 or higher. That might be textbooks. Or you can even find books that Amazon's not selling. You can filter by sales rank. So maybe you want to keep it under 500,000, and then you can play with the publication date. So you get to play with all these filters to help you find books that might have a good differential between merchant fulfilled and Prime. A is analyze. We've got a lot of tools there. We don't want you buying books blindly and wasting money. So we're going to take you over to Keepa or Camel, Camel, Camel. You can see how often the book is selling. C is calculate. So we've got a nice calculator that factors in the book's weight, and it helps you understand how much is, you know, what's the book going to cost me to send it in? What's Amazon going to take out at any given price? And how much profit am I going to be left with? And it gives you a range. So if you want to make 50% margin, it'll tell you what you have to list that book for before you even buy it. And then you can make a decision whether to get it or not. And then S at the end, FACS, is snag. Should you buy it when all is said and done?
Okay. All right. And so there's a fee. How much is it?
It's $79 a month. We may take that up a little bit. We're adding a lot of new features right now. We're about six weeks into its launch, and just kind of building that community. Some of the early adopters are in, and we're hoping to, you know, branch out to some affiliate networks in the near future.
Well, can you talk of any success? I mean, so $79, you know, not cheap for a service, right?
Yep.
you obviously got to make money, right? And so, you know, they got to consider that. So, you know, what could someone reasonably expect? And there are no guarantees, and it's a sure. it's an effort versus reward issue,
and
right?
Sure, there's a lot of market risk as well.
Sure.
Yeah, addressing the price, yeah, it's expensive to develop. I'm not a programmer. I had to pay to get this done by a third party,
sure.
and I'll give them a nice plug. It's 212 Media out of Warsaw, Indiana. That's my old hometown. A good friend of mine, Dave, runs the company, and one of my college business profs actually owns the company. So it was awesome to go back and work with people that I knew to develop mm-hmm. something. So it wasn't cheap. I got to pay myself back. But two, if the price is too low, then everybody gets in, and you know, there's the concern that will they buy all the good books? I don't think they will. Again, there's 100,000 books being bought on Amazon every hour, from what we can tell. So you know, even if we get 1,000 users using this software, are they even going to put a dent in that? I don't.
Not even close.
Yeah.
Not even close. So, especially because again, you're buying lower priced books.
Exactly.
Right. So you know, it's not like you're buying the premium fast selling books out there, right? Well, you might be, but you're buying them from merchant fulfilled.
Yep.
The prime buyers are buying them from the prime site, and so you're trying to take advantage of that.
Yep. And guys like Greg Murphy that merchant fulfill, you know, the majority of their books love this because now people are coming out and buying the merchant fulfilled books. They're driving up the price of merchant fulfilled, and it's going to put money in their pocket. So, you know, if you're selling merchant fulfilled, you're welcome.
Going back to your question,
how much can you make? I've got some early success stories coming in. You know, the beauty of online arbitrage with books is that if you have a full-time job, it's often tough to carve out time in the evening or on the weekend to go to thrift stores. And, of course, they close at 6 or 7 o'clock, and you can't even get in and buy the books after work in a lot of cases. So this allows you to buy books anytime as long as you have internet access. So if you're a night owl or you work first shifts and, you know, you need to carve out time to buy books, you can do it. So that's one unique piece of it. Also, we've got people in the middle of Wyoming that don't have access to thrift stores,
right.
and they can use this to actually let books show up at their front doorstep, which is cool. How much can you make? I tell people, you know, pick a specific number. For example,
I want to go there. Let's say you want 100 books a week.
Yep.
I don't care about how much you make as much as can you buy enough volume, right? Because we're already assuming that the math is good, right? Yep. We already made that assumption. So I want to know, can I buy enough inventory? That's the problem with online arbitrage generally. It's very difficult to buy sustainable, significant amount of inventory.
Yes, and there are thousands of books out there. Obviously, most people are going to look at books that are selling for a penny that can sell for 20, 30, 40. And those are out there, but that's the low-hanging fruit, and everybody's looking for it. So if you're willing to pay, even just bump your price up instead of a penny, if you're willing to pay $3, $4, $5, the number of books just opens up exponentially. So what I tell people is commit to buying 5 books a day, 5 days a week. That's 25 books a week, 100 books a month. Nothing crazy, and pick your margins. Buy books where you reasonably expect to make 100%. And if you're dropping 5 books, you know, $5 on a book, now you're making $5 on a book. When those eventually sell, you could theoretically make $500 right there. And if you're willing to spend more.
And you haven't left the house. And you haven't left the house.
Bingo.
Yeah.
And Eric, I can go out in an hour and buy 20 or 30 books. That's, you know, I was doing that already. When you scan books at the library sale and it comes up and it's showing FBA for $40 and it's, you know, $6 merchant fulfilled, I would take a screenshot, go home and buy the book. And, you know, I started doing that more and more and realized there's so many books out there that I literally could not buy them all. Mm-hmm. And one thing I'm doing too, and once you become a member, I've got a 3-day free trial of the software. So if anybody wants to try it, please take it for a test spin. Once you do pay for that first month, I will give a 15-minute coaching call for free. So I will show you, I'll jump on Skype, do a screen share, and I'll show you how I would use it or answer your questions on how to find books. And I really believe that once you have just a few strategies out there, you'll have no trouble finding books.
It's genius. Love it. And when you what you just described, where you saw the picture in your phone and then you would go out and buy it right at the thrift store because you saw the opportunity. I mean, you found the magic scan, but you didn't stop there, right? You just described it. You actually bought the next 6 books. If there were 6 merchant fulfilled customers under, you know, X number of dollars, you might have just bought them all as you're standing there. That's exponential growth. That's genius. Really smart. Really, really smart.
Well, and it's a business that's scalable. You know, my costs are the same whether I get 1 user or 1,000 users. And so, of course, there's some hosting fees and whatnot that go into it, but the more people that use it, it doesn't take me more time to go find them other than some marketing to go, you know, and attract them.
Right.
And I love the scalability.
I love it. Okay. Give me any books, podcasts that you would recommend that you think our listeners would benefit from?
From a podcast perspective, I don't listen to too many of them. Entrepreneur on Fire, Tim Ferriss has a great one. There's some good ones there. I love anything that's a story and just getting to hear someone's story and what, you know, what they do well, what they do poorly, where their challenges have been. And again, you just learn something from those stories. Mm-hmm. A book I would highly recommend is The $100 Startup by Chris Guillebeau. And mm-hmm. he's traveled to every country in the world and found a way to kind of fund it. And for him, it's writing books and sharing stories. But what he does is he goes around and interviews tons of like unexpected entrepreneurs that didn't really, you know, they wanted to build a lifestyle business or they were stuck in a 9-to-5 job and they had skill sets. And they thought, well, I can never start my own business. It's too much money, too much risk. And he just goes and interviews people that literally started with $100 or less and just built a blog, built a website. If they were good at PR, they would get into that. If they could, you know, master languages, they'd teach people how to do that. And it's just a phenomenal read just to understand you can get started today with anything.
So it's those self-imposed boundaries are really the thing that are holding every – I mean, you're describing a business that could start for $100. Everybody has $100.
Exactly.
So it's that self-imposed boundary that's preventing you from doing that.
And everybody's got a skill set. Everybody, like you said, could carve out $100 if they had to, and it's just start it. Start it on the side. Mm-hmm. You don't have to quit your job. We didn't. We built a business on the side for 12 months before either of us stepped away.
It's great. Love it, love it, love it. Okay, so the goal of this podcast is to help people move forward, right? So they're kind of stuck, right? They still have those boundaries, right? I guess I'm going to probably start harping on that more and more and start helping tear down those boundaries, right? But give us a tip or trick that you think that people can put in their business to help them get past stuck.
Well, there's nothing profound here, but just get started. Whatever you have in mind, like I talked to a guy today that wants to start an Amazon business, and I told him, hey, go home right now, start your account, open your account. You know, just get it started. It doesn't cost you anything. Just pick a name, you know, fill out the paperwork, off you go. Just get started because otherwise it's just an idea in your head until you actually do something with it. If you're already started, then find a way to get out of your own way. The best growth we've had in you know, what I'm really trying to do is find ways to outsource pieces of the business. And whether that's with a virtual assistant, go to Fiverr.com. You can find awesome, you know, if you need help with a website or a logo or anything, there's somebody doing it out there relatively cheap. So if you're not started yet, get started today. Don't delay. And if you are doing something, figure out a way to get out of your own way.
That's great advice. Oh, man. This has been a great interview. I'm really, really, really pleased. I got to go thank the person who said I needed to have you on, and they were dead set right. Best way to get in touch with you. Now, I'm going to have a link for thebookflipper.com.
Yep.
And on there in the top right-hand corner is eFlip, which you said it's 3 days free. Hey, what do you got to lose?
Yeah,
go try
the world,
it.
Right? See what you think.
You know, you don't like it? Boom, you're out. What's the other way to get in touch with you?
Other than that, you can just drop me a line, thebookflipper@gmail.com. And if you just want to chat business or ask a question, whether it's about books or not, I'd love to just chit-chat or learn from you. So that's the best way to get a hold of me. I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/thebookflipper, and then also on Facebook, facebook.com/thebookflipper.
Okay, and I'll have all the links for that. Man, I appreciate you taking the time. I know you got a lot of flipping to do. I just really do appreciate, though, that you've really broke down your process. You're pretty pretty visible. You're letting it all hang out, and I think that, you know, you're saying, hey, work hard and you can be successful like me, period. Right? No secrets. I mean, it's
no. There's work hard. There's nothing proprietary, unique, extra special, anything that I'm doing. It's just take something that's out there, tweak the model, play with it, and you know, be willing to work hard at it.
That's great. Put your head down, do the work.
You got it.
Man, I really appreciate it. You have a great night. Wish you nothing but success this year, and tell Greg I said hey.
I will. Thanks, Stephen.
Take care.
All right. It's pretty awesome. So, you know, this is interesting. I have another book flipper coming up, and, you know, book selling is how I think most of us got started originally selling on Amazon because, let's face it, it was such a, you know, a prevalent place. It was the place to sell. But, you know, it seems to be a resurgence coming back as I look out there. It is a great opportunity that he's offering. You know, think about it. If you could identify opportunities to do arbitrage with books, and generally speaking, now, there are counterfeit books, especially textbooks, so be cognizant of that. However, you know, if you could find an opportunity to do some online arbitrage of regular books and sell them, I just think it's a great opportunity. The cool thing is Caleb's offered a discount of $5 in perpetuity. So if you sign up through the link on my website,
you'll get $5 off as long as you're a subscriber. And I think that's pretty cool of him to do, and I really appreciate that. I really think you ought to think about diversifying your mix. Randy Reynolds said it. He looks at his inventory as a portfolio. That way he can ride the ups and the downs of the market. Think about it. Man, I appreciate you listening. I hope you get something from this. I know I got a lot from it. Check us out, E-Commerce Momentum. Again, I'm going to have all the links, and especially I'm going to have the link for Caleb's program, which I really think is a great idea. I think it's a great way to diversify, and it's a great way to really get solid in online arbitrage. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. All the links mentioned today can be found at ecommercemomentum.com under this episode number. Please remember to subscribe and like us on iTunes.